Okay, Don.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. The erotic or deeply erotic. Our author reminds us that the erotic isn't just about the body, but also about the soul. And sadly, we see that the repression that finds when there is no expression can be capitulated or seen in, quote, the scandal of Catholic priests engaged in cruel abuse. So if we want to control desire and eros, vows are not foolproof. That is the kind of repression that Freud found, and, you know, Freud was considered like a dirty therapist, you know, because he was interested in exploring sexual desire, not realizing that the repression, what the repression does is when the expression will come up, it comes up in bizarre and sometimes sadistic, sometimes masochistic, but sometimes sadistic forms. And there's no way that you could not say that sexual abuse of children is sadistic. So it is even possible that religion may be a cause or an occasion of depression or repression in any one of us, especially those of us who are well past childbearing years. Eros may be more about life and meaning. We can think of eros as the longing for life. This activity, this longing, does not imply increased activities, but rather it reflects a saying yes, yes to life. At a retreat I gave at La Casa de Maria, I read this poem, and I got through it. I hope I can get through it again today. It is from Sappho, who is a 6th century B.C. Greece. At that time, I think I'll say it again, Sappho lived and worked on the island of Lesbos, which is an island very much in the news now because it's one of the passageways to Greece. I don't know if you know that Lesbos is only 5 miles from Turkey. You know, our islands are 12 miles. So that little bit of journey they do is fraught because of the enormous energy of the ocean at that place and the frailty of those dinghies that people pour hundreds of people on. Anyhow, this is Sappho. It's a fragment. Most of her poetry is in fragment style. Already old age is wrinkling my skin, and my hair is turning from black to gray. My knees begin to tremble, and my legs no longer carry me. Oh, but once we were like young deer. What can I do? It's not possible to return to my youth. For even Eos, the dawn, whose arms are roses, who brings light to the ends of the earth, found that old age embraced Tithornus, her immortal lover. It is not possible to return to my youth. I know I must die, yet I love the tenderness of life, and this and desire keep me here in the brightness and beauty of the sun, and not with Hades. Isn't that marvelous? If you are at the point in your life where your spouse has died and the thought that another relationship is not in the works, yet you miss opportunities of being with the opposite gender. I want to say congratulations for being here, because by coming here, you have already found one place in which you can be with each other's company. There are plenty of other places. Places of worship might be one. But I think we still need energy from the opposite gender, and to find a place in which we can explore that and enjoy it. I want to tell you of a little story. This one continues to amaze me. There's a woman, she's possibly in her 80s, who comes to our dance club. I'm a member with my husband of the Stardusters. We dance once a month at the Elks. I was curious when I saw her there with a much younger man. I found out he was her dancing instructor. I was surprised and thrilled for her that she didn't have to sacrifice her desire to dance just because she wasn't in a relationship. Her husband had died about 20 years ago. But I still was perplexed. Then I found out she was a European. She was from Budapest. Then it all made sense. Ladies, European women are just not as inhibited as we Americans are. You know, you could just look at her face to see there's not in there a lot of thoughts of what will people think of me if I come to a dance with my instructor. I mean, oh, well, also that she had the money to pay for herself and her instructor twice, you know, once for his time and once to pay the club. But it is, to me, it constantly renews to me that, reveals to me that it's okay to find where you're vital and not to sort of sit in a kind of masochistic pout. That you can't do this or that. So, at the beginning, when I talked of the Song of Songs, that it only passed muster to be in the canon because it was accepted as an allegory for God and God's people, I want to now talk about sort of the reverse. In a typical Hillmanian way, that when we are in a non-dualistic world, it is not valuable to affirm only one way. Like, the primacy is in the couple playing around hide-and-seek, and this is a kind of cool abstraction about God and God's people. But I was introduced to this when I had a Pacifica professor say, don't ever say it's only a metaphor about anything. Okay, so here too, it's only a metaphor. He said, a metaphor is what is. The associated image, the underlying image, is the only. So here I am talking and I want to redeem from our discussion that simultaneously, at the same time, this book of Canticle of Canticles is about our relationship with God and the hide and seek. The thing that's so amazing about it is it talks about an equality between us and that or whatever we call the divine. This teacher was a teacher of the unseen. She wanted us to grasp the pattern in the unseen that they are and we are not the forerunners or the base, but we are an example of that image. I'm reading now a good bit of Laszlo, Laszlo of the Club of Budapest, actually, he wants to know, is there life after death? Who doesn't? You know, and he comes to the argument of it with about five or six experiments. The one that might be most commonly talked about would be that when you're in a near-death experience and you're on the table and your brain is dead, flatlined, that many people, and he gives examples of them, come back and could tell you all the conversation, everything. So what he establishes painstakingly through this book is the ability of consciousness to exist separate from the brain. Now, you know, many materialistic, in the sense of matter is the only thing that is materialist, would say that's impossible. But there's a preponderance of evidence. And he then goes on to talk about how this kind of idea of consciousness having a separate kind of existence is precisely what Jung was talking about when he talked about the archetype. The archetype is sort of like that bundle of consciousness which we dip into from time to time. But it has a life of its own, and it is, you know, without putting down materiality, it's not present in Earth as we see it. It might be present in the same way that Earth is, in that it is about consciousness of the coming together of certain atoms. I read a lot in science. I'm a baby in it, so I get books like Hidden in Plain Sight on my Kindle for 99 cents, and I learn a little bit about why is it we touch something like this and it's hard, and we touch a ray of light and we go through it, you know? Well, and he explains the difference, can you? And it all has to do with magnetism, things like that, that are real in science, but they're unseen. So we cannot say that unseen things have no wave function. Actually, I'm going over, but I can't resist. This morning in the news is that at least the work of 1,000 scientists have come together in which for the first time they are able to get a sense of gravitational energy. Now, we'd say, oh, no, I know about gravitational energy. I'm not floating up there. But they're talking about it in the whole fabric of the world. I mean, there's been, the way it's written about, it's a huge jump through in which they think retroactively we'll have to go back and look at things as different. But this had been foreshadowed or foretold by Einstein, looking at the equations. To come back to this and then open, I want to posit in closing that anything we say about love or desire or pleasure, we want to know these in the flesh, but we also need to know they are sacred reality. They have a reality beyond us, and we are one example of it. And who knows, in the multiple universes that scientists suggest are there, you know, those guys who do,
astrophysics?
Yeah, but the quantum theory. But out here at the university, we have people who have a particular model of it that requires 9 or 10 dimensions. String theory. So it's like, what's happening with all those other dimensions? You know, who else is in this room? You know, have we honored them? The angels and the, you know, all of that. They are also in some kind of constellation. But Eros, desire, and pleasure, we have hosted you today. And we want you to know that we see you as a sacred reality. And I think whether or not we use the God word, These things, eros, desire, love, pleasure, they ennoble us because they are noble. So what I want to hear from you all is anything across the board. I don't think we have to desire one. I'm happy to hear from people who disagree with me. I have happy to hear from you who say, oh, I wish you had talked on so-and-so, and I'll let them talk on so-and-so because they have something to bring in their wishing. And for us to have a dialogue, I open myself to questions. I'm not sure I can answer every question, but I think it could be very nice for us to have a conversation here. And let's see who comes to the mic. Linda.
Yes, hi. I had something I could share from the Mother Peace Tarot deck that depicts the different archetypal images. Mm-hmm. And the star goddess is one they use. That's a very beautiful image of this idea of the stardust, but incorporated in the feminine. And there's one line that always stuck in my mind, and where it's actually a prayer, because I, the line that sticks is something to the effect that all acts of love and pleasure are my ritual, and I am the place you arrive at the end of desire.
All acts of love and pleasure are
my ritual.
Uh-huh, my ritual. Let that penetrate. Say the whole thing again.
All acts of love and pleasure are my rituals. So, you know, rituals, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So acts of love, and just the idea of the sacredness of it, but they're actually a ritual form, the acts of love and pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another thing that strikes me from the I Ching, and at first I was puzzled by it, but of late I've thought, oh, yes, this is so very true. And again, within this context, but it identifies intellect and sexuality are problem children, and they must be treated fairly and justly from the very start.
Oh, how lovely.
Yeah.
How lovely.
When you asked us, can you hear me when I talk like that? When you asked us the first question, it brought back immediately to my mind my upbringing, which was probably not much different from anybody else's of this generation. I was Catholic, but still, that you were raised to be a nice girl, a good girl. And no matter what you actually were and how you actually behaved, you were that, you carried that. And I just slanked on to me. I'm almost 80 years old, and I still carry that with me. Uh-huh. I've done lots of things in my life. I won't go into that. But I don't know how many of us have been framed. Now, the second thought with that was that my mother, with her generation, never gave me, you know, I'm the oldest of 12 children, she never gave me the sex talk. Mm-hmm. And the nuns that I was went to school with didn't either, of course. And so when I had my daughter, I have two children, but one's a girl, I could not give her the sex talk.
Mm-hmm.
But my daughter was able to talk everything with her two daughters. And I thought it took two or three generations to break through that awful good girl frame that we have lived with. And it's so interesting to hear it, you know, it come out in the open.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
The Ursulines, one of the things they decided to do for us, I graduated from high school in 1954, and every one of us girls had to go into the parlor to meet with the parish priest, Father Benedict, and he went through the facts of life with us. Took a half an hour for each person. I thought that was one way of bridging the gap.
Wow.
It was amazing. I had asked my mother the questions many years earlier, and she said, well, you know, we have cats in the house. What do you... How do you think they came? And she went and sort of like told me what she could imagine to telling me. You know, it was sparse, but it was based in metaphor. It's something like what kitties do. And all I knew is that they do it a lot because we always.
This concept of pleasure. I went to a workshop recently, and the gentleman said, and it was called like your vital calling, so it wasn't anything erotic at all. Mm. But one of the questions he asked in this inquiry process asked us to ask ourselves is, what brings you pleasure? Mm-hmm. And that was just such an interesting question, because I realized I never asked myself that, like never really set with what brings you pleasure. Mm-hmm. That's different than what brings you joy and mm-hmm. what brings you happiness
yes.
and what brings you fulfillment. It went right to this concept of pleasure. And I sat with it, and things like came my morning coffee.
Mm-hmm.
My morning coffee brings me pleasure. Now, I'm 56. I drank coffee for years. Now I savor it. Just putting my awareness to it, I was always having the experience probably, mm-hmm. but I wasn't inhabiting that experience.
You weren't conscious of it.
I wasn't receiving the fullness, and my awareness of where it was that brought me pleasure, even petting my dog, things I do a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I would just, it just opened up a whole new way to be with those things that I do in my life
mm-hmm.
that actually bring me pleasure.
How nice.
And just feel the richness of that. So I don't know what you could speak to about that, but.
Well, I'm very grateful to your saying that. And it would be another exercise to say, you know, now that maybe some of the years and the guilt and all that kind of associations have gone by the wayside along with other things, you know, what does bring you pleasure? And, you know, it might be buying concert tickets. This Sunday they're advertising at the symphony, Santa Barbara Symphony, a Valentine concert with Rachmaninoff doing one of his, not the violin concerto, which is mine. I think the violin concerto is the most exotic thing, but variations. That is, well, and the other one also. I have it written down in my notes, but I didn't quite get it. I mean, there's so many things that you could be pleasuring yourself with without even avoiding the big fear of loss. You know, I mean, the pleasure is in the moment you drink your coffee. It's experience near. It's not something. I'm going to try to do something that I've never done in June. I'm going to Ecuador, and I want to do the zip line. But to do the zip line, you just really have to trust that these people who have done it hundreds and thousands of times, that will hold you, you know? But some of my grandkids have done it. So it's like I'm really behind. Bob?
While you're on the subject of pleasure, I have to tell you an unusual item that gives me pleasure, and it didn't start until the 21st century.
Mm.
But it is, I have Christmas three times a week because I order so much stuff from Amazon. I get a package very often. It's really a pleasure to see something when and a lot of it is the books for Word and Life, but you know, even that is something. But the idea of getting gifts other
yes.
than on Christmas is very pleasurable.
And how lovely. Thank you. Yes. Yes.
Hi, Don.
Hi.
I was wondering if you went to the mind supermind once and
because I had meant to bring the book and I forgot.
Uh-huh.
But there was a woman who spoke, and her book was Transcendent Sex.
Uh-huh.
And it was absolutely fascinating. She spoke of a personal experience where during the sexual act she had a full-blown mystical experience.
I can believe it.
So, anyway, it seems like our Catholic upbringing has kind of cut us off from something that's a portal to the divine.
Exactly.
You know? So it's pretty sad, because what she was talking about, most of us were like, wow, you know? And then she did her PhD on it, uh-huh, and found out that it is very common,
mm-hmm,
you know? So, anyway, I wonder how they still manage that, but do you remember her? Have you seen her?
I don't know. I don't know the book, but I'll Google it.
Yeah, so I have it at home, but I thought that was absolutely, uh-huh, fascinating that the very people who vilified it kind of shut us off of a portal to the divine.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
So anyway, thought I would.
So I had thought one of the questions I might get from you is, what do I think of masturbation?
Boy.
I think it's good. I think there are limits to masturbation, as there are limits to anything, you know, even eating apple pie. Some of the prohibitions in the secular world come for athletes, you know. If you masturbate, you're not as acutely sort of ready in your body because you have sort of gotten a relief, and so you might not have intercourse, or you might not have masturbation prior to a game. There's a lot of that in the literature, but I have to say, what the hell is wrong with masturbation? That it is it is so prohibited, even today, in many traditions. And if the argument is its goal should be the conception of a child, and this is clearly not going to do it, where are we in terms of not looking at the world? We need to have less people, more, not more. The planet is really in extremis around that, especially if much of the arable land is not going to be arable because there won't be moisture to keep it working. So it perhaps in the early days when we had a sort of need to engage in sex only in order to bring the next generation, you could argue that anything that wasn't open to new life was a sin. Now, I'm telling you what I think. I'm in no way expecting that people would have the same experience that would bring them to the conclusion that I have come to. But I did feel like I would have liked to have been asked the question. So, right. So, but I felt I shouldn't. I shouldn't be afraid to tell you what I think. Yeah.
And thank you for that. I didn't even take notes because you're so interesting. I'm just engaged. I didn't take notes. So, I'm Gloria. I just wanted to mention. I think I got this right. Saint Therese, the little flower. I think she's a doctor within the church, and she had ecstasy. There was so I just wanted
don't to confuse her with Teresa of Avila.
No, I'm
Teresa of Avila is the passionate one.
Right.
You
I'm
look at any
about
pictures of her, and boy, she is in sexual ecstasy.
Maybe that's the one I'm thinking.
I think you are, because Teresa of
Lisieux, yes,
the little flower, Teresa of Lisieux, is an incredible figure,
yes,
and to read a modern biography of her is really amazing.
That's who I was
Therese of Avila is the doctor of the church, and she and John of the Cross are really masters on the mystical state. And she's the one who read this seven-story mountain and wrote about the many layers and many
right
paths in coming to union with God. But both of them are quite amazing women, and one's 16th century and the other's 19th century. So there was a good bit of time between the two.
I was speaking of the young one that died.
Uh-huh.
And I think
they all died.
No. she was a young one that died early. And so I was thinking, she talked about ecstasy with God. So I'm just saying there's another side of the coin within the Catholic Church.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That's all I'm saying.
Yes. But see, the other side of the coin was you could do it in mysticism, because Thérèse of Avila had laid that down, and John of the Cross, too. And, there was a whole difference in around the, centuries, right, 17th, 18th century in Europe, where, the three monotheistic religions were talking to each other.
Mm.
And that's when the whole mystical tradition developed in the religions in the Islam.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of the most exotic literature is in the Islamic poets. And they were friends in those centuries. Mm-hmm. But not all of them, the ones that were in the mystical tradition.
My only point was it wasn't the church, it was her personally. That was my point,
uh-huh.
Therese. So I'm just saying that was mm-hmm. between her and God in the mystical, not the church.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I was going to mention was, I didn't grow up Catholic, so I'm one of the few, I think, in here. But anyway, I didn't have any talk. But it was just kind of a natural progression. And it was almost like inside me, I guess. And we would play Spin the Bottle in seventh
mm-hmm.
grade. And that was a very natural way to get excited.
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to get kissed?
Mm-hmm.
And so those things were not ever stopped with me. You know, I don't even mm-hmm. know if they knew about them. But anyway, my parents. But I went to a formal when I was in the seventh grade. I had a strapless dress.
Mm-hmm.
So I just had it naturally.
Very nice.
But the secular, I think, was in that the good girl and the virgin. I did have that in me, but that was kind of like, yeah, that's good. I think I want that.
Mm-hmm.
So I would maybe do everything but that, but have sex
mm-hmm.
in that way,
mm-hmm.
whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I wanted to mention as far as masturbation and one of the other pieces to that is sexual addiction.
Hmm.
And having worked at a treatment center, that is a very, very serious addiction. So I'm just saying there's and I think you bring that out, that
mm-hmm.
there's kind of a middle road in things, not
mm-hmm.
this or that.
Yeah.
And so, around
that point, thank you for bringing it up.
Okay.
I do think there's such a thing as pornography, and it is a deadening of eroticism. And that the thing in that is one of the addictions that is as bad as addiction to heroin or to cocaine is addiction to pornography. And so much of that comes about through the availability on the internet of pornography. And it is sort of follows that rule, you get so much for doing so little. You know, so that a kind of eroticism that comes out of looking at pornography in which you have to do it over and over again, because those hormones have become insatiable, I think is a real serious problem. I have never treated someone for the addiction, but I've known people in this town who were ministers who had to go through a desensitization in order to get rid of the addiction to pornography. I mean, it's no small thing. So I don't want to be glib. Yes, Cindy.
Thank you, Dawn. And thank you in particular, because my reaction to this book was, and his other books, Thomas More's other books, mm-hmm. was he doesn't have a body in it.
Mm-hmm.
He talks a lot about spirit and soul, but there is a real lack of embodiment. And you really picked up on that.
Hmm.
I have to share with you just two things. I'll be brief because I know we're almost ending. But I saw Thomas More and Richard were together at Loyola Marymount in the 80s, and Thomas More had just written his book, his first book. And I just wasn't getting it. Mm-hmm. And I got it, but it was not full. And Richard Rohr knew that some of us weren't getting it. And what he said, and it wasn't a reaction to Thomas More, but what he said was that there is a soul and a body. a soul and a spirit. The spirit, he drew a triangle, and the soul is here, the spirit is here. The body is in the center of the triangle.
Hmm.
And it's the body that interacts the soul and the spirit.
Hmm.
And for some of us who live just in soul, which I think a lot of women do, hmm. we can get depressed, we can just be in the mud of life, that our goal is to raise up. But our body will tell us that through depression, through other diseases. Okay. We'll raise up to seek spirit.
Hmm.
But the idea of spirit is that they have to fall.
Hmm.
And to get soul. And I just feel that way about the... about Thomas More. I'm too much of a body person, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is I learned from a monastery, a Benedictine monastery, that the word amen has a very sexual tone to it. And it's because when women say it, we say, ah,
man.
I think Elizabeth last week did a nice thing on the difference of one of the differences of spirit and soul. I can't remember to repeat it. I don't know if you care to. But right now my mind won't give me any specifics. I only have a felt memory of it. I think we can say that soul is more yin and spirit is more yang, you know, and that might help us get a sense of the different valence. Tom, you're going to thank me and tell me.
Well, actually, I'm going to thank you and thank you all and just give you a peaceful dismissal.
Thank you.
See you next week.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Dawn.
And next week we have Thomas here.
And music.
And music.
Okay.
I hope we're going to have jazz.
I will try.
Yes.
A little Gershwin, maybe.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.